and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a look ahead to the Nevada caucuses and the South Carolina primary, which is expected to be a nasty mudslinging competition on the Republican side, and speak with Margie Omero, a managing director at Purple Strategies and the former president of Momentum Analysis, where her clients were the DNC, the DCCC, Mayors Against Illegal Guns, Emily's List, members of Congress, and campaigns across the country. We'll discuss the momentum Bernie Sanders has and Hillary Clinton's problem in this year of the outsider as a status quo candidate who wants to improve the system, not change it. Then we'll take a further look at the Bernie Sanders revolution with Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, whose latest e-book is The Burn Identity. He joins us to discuss his article at philly.com, Bernie Sanders and the Revolution of Rising Expectations, and how the festering anger in the land over income inequality, diminishing opportunity, and a general disgust with politics and politicians is now finding its voice at the ballot box. Then finally, we'll speak with Joshua Oppenheimer, a two-time Oscar-nominated film director of a new feature documentary up for this year's Academy Awards Best Feature Documentary. He joins us to discuss his new film, The Look of Silence, which is just out in theaters nationwide. It is a sequel to The Act of Killing, which profiled perpetrators of the 1965 Indonesian genocide as they reenact their war crimes without remorse. And joining us now is Margie Omero, who's a managing director at Purple Strategies and the former president and founder of Momentum Analysis LLC, a Democratic public opinion research firm based in Washington, D.C. Her clients include the DNC, DCCC, Mayors Against Illegal Guns, Emily's List, members of Congress, nonprofits, and hundreds of campaigns around the country. Welcome to Background Briefing, Margie Omero.
Thanks so much for having me.
And as we head to the caucuses in Nevada, and then, of course, after that, the state of South Carolina, where I believe politics is a contact sport, nastiness, venom, all kinds of dirty tricks are perfectly, that's apparently a part of the state's political tradition. Of course, we all remember how George W. Bush slimed John McCain with accusations fed by Karl Rove that John McCain had a African-American love child and all this kind of stuff. So what's your sense then of, as the less white states and the more diverse states start voting, that in effect that's Hillary Clinton's firewall?
Well, that certainly has been true up until voting began. Certainly the early polls before voting began suggested that Clinton was far stronger with non-whites than with Sanders. I think now that we've had some voting and you've had Sanders strong, very strong in New Hampshire, of course, and strong, relatively speaking, to expectations in Iowa, I think the race may scramble. And you also have, we also have to take into account the advertising that goes on in the states and outreach now that the whole race and campaign is really focusing, the spotlight is now turning to those states. Those things may change. I think the outcome actually is quite good for the party and voters overall. It's a good thing that now we're going to have the two Democratic candidates really focus on the concerns and needs of African-American voters, not just because they want to appeal to African-American voters. That means those are concerns for all of us. Those are concerns that we should all share and do all share as a party and should all be focused on as a general voting population. So I think it's a good thing that now our attention is turning toward how to best connect with and appeal to and talk to African-American and Latino voters.
But does it concern you that in Iowa the Republicans had a record turnout and in New Hampshire the Republicans had a record turnout, but in both Iowa and New Hampshire the Democrats had less voters this year than 4 years ago?
I mean, I don't know if I'm, that surprised. You had a pretty... You have a pretty big field on the Republican side, and, there are a lot of new folks, and, I think it's a little too early to tell what this all means for November. I think the you have real stratospheric turnout in Iowa, in particular in 2008, when Obama was running, and, you know, that was going to be hard to replicate. I think that going forward, there are going to be a lot of other contests on the Democratic side, on the Republican side, that will be a measure of voter enthusiasm. That will be a measure of where people are, you know, where voters are headed. And also, we have a heck of a lot more months to go before we know who the nominees are, how general election voters are going to behave, how base voters and non-early voting states are going to behave. There's just so much still not decided.
Well, my sense, and I hear this from political pundits and reporters on the ground, that Bernie Sanders not only is surprising everybody at the polls, as is, of course, Donald Trump, in terms of their election results, but I'm also told that Bernie Sanders is running a very effective campaign, a very professional campaign, and they're been on the ground in South Carolina and in Nevada, and as you know, he had breakfast in Harlem with the Reverend Al Sharpton. So what's your understanding about how much, because one of the things that's very strange, and there's almost a kind of Groundhog Day or a deja vu feeling about the Hillary campaign, that it has echoes of 2008, where she was the anointed front runner and just simply didn't run a good campaign. And, you know, she's very smart, she's a great debater, and yet somehow there's a sense that she's floundering while Bernie is off to the races.
I think it's still a little early to make final conclusions about either of the candidates. I think the Clinton campaign, from where I sit, has learned from some of the missteps from 2008, certainly in terms of the team and the team cohesion, at least from most outward appearances. I think there has been an enormous amount of folks on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire, from both campaigns. Certainly there's been a lot of field effort and spends basically equal amounts of money in both New Hampshire and both the Clinton and Sanders campaigns did. But make no mistake, I mean, there's certainly, I think the Sanders campaign is, has taken a lot of folks by surprise, just as you said. They've had a strong professional team, but more importantly, they've had a lot of enthusiasm, real organic enthusiasm from voters around the country, and that's why you see these really huge crowds. I think while New Hampshire was a setback for Clinton, to be sure, it doesn't mean that she's been rejected by voters in her party. I mean, she's still enormously popular with voters. Bill Clinton is still enormously popular with voters. I think that, you know, there's a lot more voting to be done. I think there's still, you know, there's a lot more contests to be had. There's, you know, lots more debates to be had in the next few weeks. So there's still a lot of opportunities for the race to change and then change again and then change one more time.
But just in a broad sense, though, this is the year of the insurgency, and this is the year of populist anger, both on the left and the right. A lot of anger and disgust at politics, politicians, at gridlock. And my sense is that the disadvantage that Hillary Clinton has in this election year, the year of the outsider, is that she's a status quo politician who wants to improve the system, not change it.
Well, I think you're right. There was tons of anger toward Washington and the sense that the country is going off in the wrong direction and that it's going to be very difficult to right the ship again. And that's something I hear in focus groups, whether I'm talking to Democrats or Republicans or swing voters. You see it in Gallup polling about worries about government dysfunction. At times, beating the economy is the number one issue, and that being true across party lines. So this is not a partisan worry. This is an American worry that government has just become too toxic and corrosive. And I think that the Sanders campaign, in terms of being, you know, his message about the economy and the system, political system being rigged, really can tap into that. I think, you know, the Clinton campaign argues, and I think they have a persuasive case to make here, that she's been fighting for change and been fighting for issues like women and children for decades as well, been fighting to improve health care, to be fighting to improve the economy for a long, long time as well. So I think each candidate on the Democratic side, at least, has a case to make. The question is, are they making it in a way that's crisp and also demonstrates to voters that they get where they're coming from, that they understand their struggles? The Republican side has a different kind of dynamic. I mean, they they want to. They're tapping into anger at Washington as well. You see that with Trump's candidacy. You see it with Cruz's candidacy. You even see some insiders trying to talk about how they're really going to be more like Washington outsiders, even if they're governors of big states. But they also have a different approach. Rather than fixing, trying to fix government, they want to, you know, cut away government and different components of government. So they have a different approach to what is fundamentally a similar problem, which is people feel that government is just, you know, adrift.
But when you have on the Bernie Sanders side the millennials joining in droves, and he's certainly attracting the young in enormous numbers, and you mentioned that part of Bernie's appeal is that he's letting everybody know something that they already know, which is the system is rigged. How can Hillary get around the fact that you have a blowout victory of Bernie Sanders in New Hampshire? He wins by 22 points, and yet Hillary ends up with more delegates thanks to the superdelegate arrangement. So doesn't that play into the millennials' sense that the system is rigged?
I think it's a challenging argument to make. For one, it's processy, right? It's just internal dynamics of how campaigns work, which a lot of voters are not paying as much attention to. It sounds like to some that there's a reliance on insiders or the establishment rather than on voters. I think the superdelegate argument is something that's going to come more into play later on in the spring. If and when the contest continues, then we'll continue to have the superdelegate conversation. Right now, there's early voting. There's, you know, real voters to listen to, real voters to talk to. It's not just polls. It's not just establishment. It's something that is, you know, really about hearing what voters have to say. And I think that's what most people are focused on in the short term.
Well, in the last debate, Hillary Clinton brought up the issue of the fact that she has been thoroughly vetted and made it pretty clear that she was implying that Bernie Sanders hadn't been thoroughly vetted. And as we mentioned in the beginning, Margie O'Meara, going into South Carolina, that's a very nasty state where throwing out all kinds of innuendo and sleaze is business as usual. I understand on the Republican side, you know, you've already got prominent bloggers in the state talking about how they're going to drop a mistress bomb on one of the Republican candidates. Apparently it's Marco Rubio, who allegedly has some mistress down in Florida he bought a house for. So we'll see what happens. We know that on the Republican side, the mud's going to fly. What's going to happen on the Democratic side?
I think you won't see anything like the intensity and crassness and craziness on the Republican side, on the Democratic side. It just simply won't be that kind of personal slugfest. The candidates will, rightly, draw a contrast with each other. That's their job, not just to say what they're for, but also to say how that's different from the other person. Otherwise, that illustrates the differences for voters. If the two candidates are exactly the same on everything, then there's not much of a contest. There's not much of a decision to be made. So it makes sense for the Democrats to be talking about the contrast between the two. Now, on the Republican side, when you have, I just see up on my screen a quote about a Cruz ad mocking Rubio for being just a pretty face. That's in an ad. That's not just an aside at a rally or something. You had Trump using really grotesque words about Cruz at a rally in the last day or two. I mean, the stuff that goes on that side is really childish at times. It's not very presidential. It's something that we should, their party, I know parts of their party are, embarrassed by. It's an embarrassment to our process and to the office. You don't see that on the Democratic side. When we have debates on the Democratic side, they may be heated, they may be intense, they may be about serious issues. They're just not going to be at quite as personal and insulting as you see on the right.
But every time, though, that Donald Trump crosses the line, and he's done it repeatedly, it doesn't seem to hurt him. If anything, it draws out more voters. And that's one of the things I think there's a real anomaly this year. It's not just the year of the outsider. It's that people are being drawn into the political process by that kind of anti-politician, anti-establishment, often crude rhetoric, that this could indicate as they say, as I mentioned earlier, there was a record turnout in Iowa amongst Republicans and a record turnout in New Hampshire. So, you know, a lot of political analysts over the years have always said, well, if more people voted in the United States, we'd have more people voting Democrat and voting, working people voting in their interests. I'm not sure that's a valid prediction.
Well, the contests and the electorates in Iowa and New Hampshire are very different on the Republican side, for sure. In Iowa, you saw new caucus goers turnout. You saw also an increase in previous caucus goers turnout and a surge in evangelical turnout, which is part of the reason that Cruz won. In New Hampshire, you had undeclareds voting because in New Hampshire, people of any party can vote. Undeclareds can vote in either party's primary, I mean. And that helped John Kasich, who came in second. So they're pretty different, I think, what happened there. And as far as Trump's strength, it is disturbing. The question is, does he have a ceiling? Just because he's won one contest and came in second in another contest doesn't mean that his style can win in a general election across the country. He in a lot of polls, he's, you know, net unfavorable. Even Republicans in the last Iowa poll said that they'd be embarrassed if he was the nominee. You have a lot of party insiders saying that publicly and privately that they wish he wasn't the nominee, that they're embarrassed by him. That you have a lot of voters expressing some dismay about his strength. So there is a group of people that find his message appealing, and at times that message is really, as I said, unpresidential and just inappropriate for public life. And what I think a lot of folks are responding to is they just want something different, that they're just so sick of the usual that they'll take just something completely different, and that, you know, he's an example of that. You can at least say he's different, you know, if nothing else.
But in South Carolina, on the Republican side, as the mud is thrown, what's extraordinary about Trump is that if they say to him, his opponents, you know, you're a three times divorced casino owner, you know, which to Christian fundamentalists and the religious right, they're sort of dens of iniquity, you know, I don't think it's going to hurt him one bit. And I think he has an amazing ability to say, sort of, you know, shrug and look at the questioner and say, so what, you know?
Yeah, I think some people find refreshing about him is he's not trying to explain away some of these things, at least. He's saying, yeah, this is my background. He's not coming up with some sort of pat answer about why X, Y, and Z happens. He either says it's not true, I don't know what you're talking about, or he is unapologetic, and I think people find that refreshing.
Well, just in closing,
doesn't make his policies any safer or more sound.
Right. I was going to say, what policies?
Yeah.
apart from everything is going to be huge, you know.
So,
in the last minute there, I just want to quickly touch on Nevada. Obviously, there's more diversity in Nevada and a substantial Latino vote. What's your predictions there on both, starting with the Democratic side and then the Republican side?
I mean, you know, I haven't seen anything new, you know. I haven't seen any new polling in either state. It's hard to really make a prediction based on everything we've seen so far. There's still, you know, at least in the timeline of a campaign, a lot of stuff that could happen. I think it's going to be a lot closer than people expect on the Democratic side in both states. Who will win? I can't say based on what we see and so far that's public. And if anybody looking at the same public data that I have tells you otherwise, then they're just making a conjecture rather than something that they see in the data. On the Republican side, I mean, it certainly seems like Trump has a lot of momentum. I think that the electorate there probably benefits Cruz in South Carolina. But the question is whether he can close the gap in time. He's certainly been on the move in South Carolina, but can he narrow that gap pretty quickly? I think Marco Rubio, you know, has stalled as a result of his debate performance last weekend, but we'll see if he can rebound. But Cruz is on the move in both Nevada and in South Carolina, so I don't know sort of where this how it all shakes up, but I still think that you probably have Trump in the lead in both those states, with Cruz a close second, and then a battle for third from Bush and Rubio and Kasich.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Margie Omero.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Margie Omero, who's a managing director at Purple Strategies and the former president and founder of Momentum Analysis, LLC, a Democratic public opinion research firm based in Washington, D.C., where clients included the DNC, the DCCC, Mayors Against Illegal Guns, Emily's List, members of Congress, nonprofits, and hundreds of campaigns around the country. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back taking a further look at the Bernie Sanders revolution. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Will Bunch, who's an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. He blogs at Attitude, that's attitytwood.com, and he is the author of The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. And his latest book and e-book is The Byrne Identity, and he has an article at philly.com, Bernie Sanders and the Revolution of Rising Expectations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Bunch.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
And, well, obviously with this blowout victory in New Hampshire and heading on to Nevada and South Carolina, Bernie Sanders is on a roll. He has what they used to call Big Mo momentum. But my sense is that the explanation perhaps for why Hillary Clinton is floundering, or appears to be, is that essentially this is the year of the outsider, and she's a status quo politician. She wants to improve the system, not change it. And as far as I can tell, the young voters and most voters are so angry at Washington and politicians and politics that they want to change the system. And Bernie looks like the agent of change on the Democratic side, and God help us, Donald Trump is the agent of change on the Republican side.
Yes, that's very well put, and I guess we can talk about the Republicans some other time, because it's funny because they're kind of mirror images. I mean, you're seeing similar effects, but for different reasons. But let's talk about what's going on the Democratic side. I mean, as you mentioned, I wrote this piece recently called Bernie Sanders and the Revolution of Rising Expectations, and what I meant by that is, and this is a political theory that goes way back, that they find that, you know, when they study things like the French Revolution or when they study the urban riots of the 1960s, they find that people tend not to rise up in some sort of revolution. This Bernie Sanders, of course, being a revolution at the ballot box, but people don't tend to rise up when they're at their low point or they're most depressed, but when things are starting to get better, but they're not getting better fast enough. And I mean, I think if you look at the progressive or liberal electorate in America, you know, there was a lot of rallying behind Barack Obama in 2008, a lot of hope for his presidency. And I think if you talk to most progressives today in early 2016, people like President Obama. They think he's done at least a good, if not an excellent job, most of them. You know, some of them are more critical, obviously. But the criticism that many would share, I think, is that it hasn't gone far enough, that, you know, that the Obama presidency wasn't really able to shape the grip of Wall Street. You know, I think the most damning statistic about the Obama years is the fact that, you know, pretty much 95% to 99%, depending on what study you look at, of all the income gains during his presidency went to people in the top 1% of incomes. And that resonates with people. Also, let's not forget that the Obama years were the years of the Citizens United ruling by the Supreme Court, and the years that money in politics, which already was out of control before the Citizens United ruling, just went off the charts, where you have people like Sheldon Adelson and people like the Koch brothers and some, to a lesser extent, some people on the Democratic side like George Soros, but especially on the Republican side, just able to put hundreds of millions of dollars into electing their candidates. And so there's a sense of unfairness. So it's not, I've seen the last couple of days since the New Hampshire victory by Bernie Sanders, a lot of analysis saying that this is, some voters are trying to repudiate Obama's presidency. And that's, I don't see that at all. I think people just want to take it a lot farther. And like you said in the intro, Hillary Clinton is seen as playing it safe, as somebody who basically is from the status quo, who's happy with the status quo politically, but just wants to, improve things, maybe get some more health care coverage from people, maybe, a somewhat better deal for people going to college, where Bernie Sanders is out there promising, free tuition. He's got a plan for free tuition at public universities. He wants to push for single-payer health care where everybody's covered. And that type of language really energizes the Democratic base. And on the money thing, too, especially because, these voters want money out of politics. And so when they read about Hillary Clinton, having fundraisers on Wall Street, when they hear about Hillary Clinton getting $675,000 to give speeches to Goldman Sachs, which many people think was one of the worst and most abusive Wall Street firms during that era, that really resonates in a very negative way with a lot of the progressive electorate.
But the revolution, and of course, Bernie sort of had to modify that by saying no, he's just calling for a political revolution. But
yes,
as a revolution, normally right-wing revolutions are top-down and left-wing revolutions are bottom-up. This appears to be more of a middle-class revolution going on in America, where the middle class feel that they're losing it. And Bernie has definitely been focusing on that from day one. So is this a different kind of revolution in terms of the angst that's out there?
And yes, we're getting confirmation of that now that after months and months of talk, people are finally voting. We're getting some confirmation of that in the numbers. Particularly in New Hampshire, people were able to look at the exit polls and look at the numbers of who voted. And to many people, one of the most stunning numbers and one of the most surprising things was the fact that white blue-collar workers, the real middle class or the working class, which broke heavily for Hillary Clinton in 2008. That's how she was able to beat Barack Obama in an upset that year. And this time around, it totally flipped, and that section of electorate went very heavily for Bernie Sanders. So, you can talk all you want about young voters, and obviously that's critical. We're talking about a landslide for Bernie Sanders on Tuesday, so he got a lot of votes from a lot of sectors. But to a lot of political analysts, his strength with lower income voters is most surprising. And I think this cuts to the fact that his campaign is so focused on unfairness. These people know about unfairness in American society because they've lived it. They particularly, and I've spent a lot of time in New Hampshire, and I've covered the New Hampshire primary in person a couple times. And you're talking about old factory towns, and yes, some of the old factories have been made into trendy restaurants, and a few of them are actually high tech enterprises, which is great, but they tend not to employ as many people. And if you're a 50-something guy and you don't have a college diploma, you're probably not going to get a job at that high-tech enterprise. Your job was probably outsourced to China or outsourced to Mexico. And so you see that. When I was reporting the Byrne identity last fall, I had an opportunity to talk to, scores of people at different Bernie Sanders rallies and ask them why they were there. And some of the most common themes I heard were you know, they wanted a government that would help them with things like college tuition, you know, that they had a son who was, you know, 27 and still living in their basement because he couldn't pay back his college loans, or, you know, they wanted more done on paid sick leave because, you know, they've been working 45 hours a week and then racing around trying to take care of a sick husband or a sick parent or something like that. And, you know, and a lot of these folks who suffer the most, you know, from high college tuition, from lack of health care coverage, from lack of paid leave, are people in the working class. So it really shouldn't be surprising, I think, that his message is finding a home with these voters.
Well, going into Nevada, of course, there, which is a very heavily unionized town, and that's where the Democrats are getting most of their votes, apparently a lot of rank and file support Trump because of his position in the outsourcing of jobs. It's something that working Americans feel very strongly about, and quite understandably so. Do you think, I mean, I don't think Hillary's very strong on this, and I'm not even sure that Bernie's as strong on this as is Trump.
Well, that's an interesting point, and you know, I spent a few days out in Nevada during the reporting for the Byrne Identity, and was out there when they had that first debate back in October, and got to meet a lot of voters, you know, including some of Hillary's voters out there who tended to be usually involved with unions that had endorsed the Clinton campaign, and I met a lot of Bernie's people out in Nevada. Because of the circumstances, I didn't really meet too many Trump voters. But I will say this. I mean, Nevada clearly is a much more ethnically and racially diverse state than the first two states where we had primaries and caucuses. Its African American population, I think, is 9%, which is just short of the national average, and its Latino population. I don't know the percentage, and I apologize for that, but I know it's much, much higher than the national average as it is in much of the Southwest. You know, and these groups are overly represented in the Democratic Party, obviously. So a couple things about that. One, I think the white voters, and especially white Republicans, feel this competition for jobs and maybe see it in kind of some of the stark, crude terms that Donald Trump sees it more than maybe somebody in New Hampshire would. You know, that it's not just you know, it's not just they have a hard time getting a job, but they unfortunately they might blame Latinos or whatever for losing their job. And, you know, so, you know, here's Donald Trump promising to build a wall and get Mexico to pay for it, and he's you know, claiming that undocumented immigrants from Mexico are rapists, and most of this is untrue. A lot of it's terrible, but you know, it's resonating with some angry voters who are looking to blame, and the kind of voter who's looking to blame. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, clearly, you have a lot of people in the working class who are unhappy and they're looking for somebody to blame. You know, the Bernie Sanders campaign is heavily focused on the role of the 1% and the idea that you know, the millionaires and billionaires need to be taxed at a higher rate, that there should be a tax on Wall Street speculation. That's what would pay for his college tuition plan. Donald Trump and the people voting for him are, you know, age-old American story, blaming the people at the bottom, you know, that people from different racial or ethnic groups are stealing their jobs, you know, that immigration is what is what's undermining this country, and that taking on immigration will, quote, make America great again. So, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's almost like a lot, you know, how, you know, everybody, the root problem is the same, you know, lack of jobs and lack of help in terms of college tuition or health care, et cetera, for working class people. But the solutions are kind of different depending on, I guess, your psychological makeup and who you're inclined to blame.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, Will Bunch, most of the focus, of course, in our conversation is focused on the presidential race. Mm-hmm. But there's a pretty much widespread expectation that the Republicans will hold on to the House and probably hold on to the Senate. So you'd have, if you have this agent of change, Bernie Sanders, elected president of the United States, he'd be up against the same gridlock, if not worse gridlock, than Obama's been up against. So how do you have change when you've got gridlock?
Well, you know, my reaction to that from talking to a lot of people is I sense what you said is just true, but I think that kind of helps Bernie in a strange way, because I think a lot of voters feel that The Republicans, if they're going to control Congress, they wouldn't approve or even vote on most of Obama's agenda for the last 8 years. And it doesn't matter if it's Hillary or if it's Bernie, because that they're going to be blocking any Democratic president's agenda. So that almost liberates voters in a sense to go with the one who they like better. That they're not. I think a lot of voters aren't factoring into that calculation. I mean, it's a sad fact of American political life in the last 15 years. But people at this point almost take gridlock for granted. They expect gridlock, and you know, a lot of the progress President Obama's made has been through executive orders on things like climate change and things like gun sanity. You know, he's had to restore it to executive orders, and that's not really how the system's supposed to work. But I think a lot of voters get that, and I think they're making maybe different judgments on who should be in the Oval Office based on our current politics than the judgments they might have made back in, say, the 1990s or 1980s.
Well, Will Bunch, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, Ian, thanks for having me on anytime. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Will Bunch, who's an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. His latest book and e-book is The Bern Identity, and he has an article at philly.com, Bernie Sanders and the Revolution of Rising Expectations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the two-time Oscar-nominated film director of the new feature documentary, The Look of Silence. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joshua Oppenheimer, a two-time Oscar-nominated film director based in Copenhagen, who recently spent 12 years in Indonesia before returning with two documentary films, the first of which, The Act of Killing, profiles perpetrators of the 1965 Indonesian genocide as they reenact their war crimes without remorse. That film is followed up with his new feature documentary nominated for this year's Academy Award, The Look of Silence, which is just out in theaters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Oppenheimer.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the Indonesian genocide that you portray in your first film, An Act of Killing, and which is also to some extent in your new film, since the main character in your film, Adi Rukun, an optometrist, watches the footage from your first film as he, as a sort of citizen in effect, goes on a journey to find out who the perpetrators of the murder of his brother Ramli were, a brother being murdered in 1965 and was done so in the clear view of multiple witnesses. Of course, it starts out with silence and this sort of surreal picture of the ruse by which Aki got to these people was he put them through this optometrist test to get them new eyeglasses. But then you also have those chrysalises moving. They're like sort of almost like coffee beans moving and twitching, and it's, I guess, the chrysalis is the butterfly about to be born. So is that the metaphor for Indonesia today? They've had an election where the first time a non-military candidate is president, but it's also a country that's still dominated by the past.
Well, I think that metaphor in film is never so neatly interpreted. I mean, for a metaphor to work as more than a simple symbol, it has to have an enduring mystery. So I'd be hesitant to say that the jumping beans are a kind of metaphor for anything so specific, but they do embody a kind of hope. There's a sense of a sign of life where you wouldn't normally expect it, and something you would overlook if you passed them on a path. If there were those beans among the pebbles on the verge of the path, you would overlook them. But there's a sense here that there's something stirring, there's something there that wants to come out. And so I would say that the two opening shots of the film that you describe embody that.
But when you went there, I take it you felt that, you know, after learning all of this hideous stuff, and I must say that the testimony from those that perpetrated these murders is they sort of very matter-of-factly take you through to the very spot where they killed over 10,000 people. And it was very personal. They were slitting throats and chopping people's heads off with machetes. In a way, the casual way in which they describe what they did is almost more horrifying than actually being able to see the footage yourself. And I take it that during the filming, you've been quoted as saying you wondered whether you had wandered into Germany 40 years after the Holocaust, only to find the Nazis still in power.
That's exactly why it's more horrifying. I don't think it's almost more horrifying. I think it is, because if you see archive footage of an atrocity, you're watching a record from the past. And we know, as terrible as these crimes are, we know that they happen again and again all over the world. But what is evidenced by the way the men are speaking is a terrible impunity, the fact that they're still in power, that they're free to boast, that no one has ever forced them to admit what they've done was wrong. And as I think both my films in different ways reveal, all the perpetrators boast defensively. They desperately try to take these bitter, rotten memories and sugarcoat them in the sweet language of a victor's history, which is available to them because they've won, so that they can live with what they've done. But at the same time, even if human morality, sort of very counterintuitively, lies behind their boasting, the boasting is an act of further evil. It clearly keeps a whole society in the grips of fear, silencing the public, enabling the leaders to commit terrible exploitation and get away with it with impunity. So I think what's terrifying about the, if you like, reenactments or descriptions of the killing by the perpetrators today is the sense that this genocide in a terrible way hasn't ended, that it's still going on because the perpetrators are in power, there's been no acknowledgement, and millions of people are still living in fear. And although that's not said explicitly in the perpetrators' presentation of what they did, we know it. It's implied. We feel it. And I think it's horrifying to behold.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Oppenheimer, a two-time Oscar-nominated film director based in Copenhagen, who recently spent 12 years in Indonesia before returning with two documentary films, the first of which, The Act of Killing, profiles perpetrators of the 1965 Indonesian genocide as they reenact their war crimes without remorse. That film is followed up with his new feature documentary nominated for this year's Academy Award, The Look of Silence, which is just out in theaters. And, of course, there has been an election of the person often referred to as Indonesia's Obama. He defeated a presidential candidate who came out of the ruling family. I think he was a son-in-law of the dictator Suharto and Prabowo. And I must say, I don't know whether you saw Donald Trump's, one of his first press conferences after he announced he's running for president, to show that he had foreign policy chops, he introduced the press to his buddy from Indonesia, who was Prabowo's bagman, and says, here's a guy we're going to make a lot of deals
with. Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, it's absolutely disgraceful.
That's upsetting.
Well, but that's why Trump is so bizarre. I mean, the first time if America elects him, it'll be like electing Putin or Erdogan in Turkey. I mean, it's an amazing turn of events. But the fact that these guys are still in power, even though they're not in power in the sense of the presidency, and obviously they overshadowed everything. They have immunity.
Well, I just want to challenge a little bit your rosy view of the Jokowi presidency. Jokowi came to power saying that he would address the 1965 genocide, saying that there should be a process of truth, reconciliation, and some form of justice. He's thus far refused to apologize, to acknowledge what happened as a crime against humanity. He's refused to apologize to the victims. He certainly refused to contemplate justice for the perpetrators. And in fact, it's easy to understand why. He's politically weak, and while he's certainly more progressive than Prabowo, he depends on men just as murderous as Prabowo for his sort of success team, as it's called in Indonesia, for his political base, for his support. He has the support of Wiranto, who was the head of the Indonesian Armed Forces at the end of the Suharto years and was implicated in war crimes in East Timor. He enjoys the support of Hendro Priyono, a former army general who is was the head of the Indonesian intelligence services and murdered Indonesia's leading human rights activist, Munir. So I think that that's not to say that Jokowi, in his heart of hearts, wants this support. I'm sure he wishes there was a strong, vocal grassroots base that was progressive, that constituted a genuine democratic basis of support. But he hasn't had that. That hasn't materialized. That said, the act of killing and the look of silence have together helped inspire a national movement against impunity in Indonesia that is growing in momentum, and the Oscar nomination for each film has helped that. But really, whether Jokowi is able to deliver on the reformist promises that he's made would depend on on him having a serious popular progressive base.
Well, indeed, there's no ambiguity in the film. You feel the omnipresence of political repression. Even the main character, Adi, as he talks to one of the mass murderers, who then starts to say, maybe you're a communist, you know, and he asks him specifics about who died and where, and he says he can't say anything. He's afraid as well. You know, even he's in that extraordinary scene with his own uncle, who said he didn't kill anybody, but he guarded them as they got aboard the trucks on their last journey to Snake River. There's no question that there's a tremendous, tremendous fear. And the propaganda that's still taught to the school children in that scene in the classroom where this rosy picture of these heroic generals who were persecuted by the communists and then only had to defend themselves by killing millions. It's, you know, the most amazing fiction.
In fact,
fiction.
There's not even, yeah.
It's an amazing fiction, but it's clearly what kids are being taught. So I'm not suggesting in any way that the generals aren't still around. And, of course, they're, because of their economic cronyism, they're not only just responsible for these atrocities of the past. My understanding is that they're responsible for the environmental destruction of the country in the present.
Exactly. I'm so glad you mentioned that. I mean, it's tempting to see a film like, to read about a film like mine without having seen it and think this is about the past. It's about a genocide 50 years ago in a country I've never heard of. It sounds depressing. Why should I see it? But not only is it not about the past, it's not a historical film. It's about repression in the present. The cronyism, the thuggery, the violence, the partnerships between the military, the perpetrators of the genocide, and private companies has plundered the country ever since 1965 and has led to really one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest environmental disaster in human history, which is the 20 years of annual burning of Indonesia's rainforest. This past year, it was the worst in history, in 2015. An area the size of New Jersey, of completely virgin rainforest, was burned, making Indonesia's carbon output exceed that of the United States. The carbon output just from the fire was that of Japan. And this has been going on for 20 years at almost this level. And the president says he's powerless to stop this, or he says he'll try to stop this, but nothing happens. And the reason for that is that major multinational and Indonesian oil palm plantation companies, and palm oil is the world's most widely used plant oil. It's used in everything from skin cream to biofuels. These plantation companies are paying small landholders and let the landless, and they themselves are sometimes doing this. They're paying people to burn down forest, or they themselves are lighting fires and burning down forest in order to clear the way for more palm oil plantations. So you have the wholesale replacement of Indonesia's rainforest, one of the most the biggest and most diverse in the world after the Amazon rainforest, with vast palm oil estates. And the thing is, the plantation companies have paid off everybody in the police and the military, from the national chiefs all the way down, and the same for regional administration. So even if the president wanted to crack down on this, even if he himself is clean, which we simply don't know, who is going to enforce any crackdown? Everybody's bought off by the plantation companies. And this, obviously, when Indonesia's carbon footprint is greater than the United States, this makes a mockery of our incremental, faltering efforts to curb global emissions, which was the sort of hopeful result of the Paris talks. And so the movement, it's not an exaggeration to say that the world may indeed depend on the success of the movement against impunity in Indonesia, the movement inspired by these two films.
Well, already as a result of the first, your first film, Joshua Oppenheimer, The Act of Killing, U.S. Senator Tom Udall has demanded the U.S. government to classify all of the CIA documents that reveal that would reveal the U.S. role in this genocide, and I don't think there's any mystery about the U.S. role. In fact, you've got in there a contemporary documentary footage from, I think, an NBC documentary where they do coverage of it, and it's just appalling how they accept the fact that this genocide is taking place. So what I was struck by is one of the mass murderers in the film says to the camera, well, you know, we did this for the Americans. He said, you guys should have sent me a plane ticket and rewarded me, I mean, or even a luxury
cruise to America.
A luxury cruise to America, because we killed all the communists for you guys, the Americans. It was absolutely devastating. So what?
Well, the fact that we see NBC almost celebrating the genocide, saying Bali is now more beautiful without the communists, which is a line spoken on the documentary and not at all criticized by the narrator of the documentary, really implicates all of us, because it suggests that just 40 years ago, just 50 years ago, Americans had sufficiently demonized whole classes of people to such an extent that we could accept their mass murder. And this really reflects on all of us. There's another moment in that NBC documentary which I think is equally important, perhaps more important, which is when they report from a Goodyear plantation almost admiringly that the Goodyear rubber plantation is harvesting its rubber for its tires using slaves drawn from a death camp. And this is, of course, what German corporations were doing on the periphery of Auschwitz. We learned that the prisoners are going back to the camps and then being dispatched out at night to death squads to be killed. And this should give all of us pause and lead us to question to what extent America's role in the 1965-66 genocide or in numerous other Cold War interventions, which led to mass killing, to what extent our role in these crimes was really motivated by ideological anti-communism, or rather, might anti-communism have been an excuse sincerely clung to, even believed by the American perpetrators of these crimes, just like the Indonesian perpetrators have their own excuses, which we see in both my films, and especially The Look of Silence. But to what extent might this anti-communism have not been the real reason for American participation, and rather may it have just been an excuse for murderous corporate plunder?
Well, the MO, of course, of what precipitated the Indonesian genocide and the military takeover was based upon a ship allegedly full of arms from communist China. And, of course, that has echoes of what happened in 1954 in Guatemala, where a ship from Czechoslovakia was supposedly coming in to supply arms to communists, and therefore the generals took over in Guatemala. The Ayatollahs, when they took over, they were given a list of all members of the Tudeh Party, the Communist Party in Iran, all of whom were massacred. So there are a pattern there, and of course it was initially an anti-Chinese kind of pogrom. But then it seemed as if it sort of morphed into just killing anybody that had a social conscience, any labor leader. Isn't that what happened?
I actually think that's a little backwards in Indonesia. I would say that it was initially a systemic attempt to kill or to put in concentration camps any likely opponent of the new regime, which included labor leaders. It included, of course, members of left-wing parties. It included journalists, writers, artists, anyone perceived to be critical or likely to become critical given the new authoritarian atmosphere. The targeting of the Chinese was actually sort of a sad footnote in this, which was that the United States produced out of its CIA station in, I think, Singapore and also Bangkok, hate radio, basically saying that every ethnic Chinese Indonesian, and the ethnic Chinese had been in Indonesia for more than a century, had ties to the people, were secret agents of the People's Republic of China, which was, you know, barely 15 years old. And this was done, I think, to drive a wedge between the new Indonesian government and the Chinese government. This was after the Sino-Soviet split, and they didn't want the new Indonesian government to align itself with Beijing, even as it was splitting its severing its ties with Moscow. They wanted it to be firmly in the camp of the United States. And this particular geopolitical strategy led to the slaughter of 50,000, an estimated 50,000 ethnic Chinese, in addition to the somewhere between 500,000 and even up to the highest estimates, 3 million Indonesians of other ethnicities who were killed.
Well, indeed. And of course, Sukarno had bought an awful lot of arms from the Soviet Union, or at least had been given effectively. But
Sukarno had received arms from both sides.
Sure.
The U.S. was, the arms were for the military, and the U.S. was grooming the Indonesian military to be loyal to the U.S. program of anti-communism and the U.S. program of corporate access to Indonesia's vast natural resources.
Right. But the idea that this was all done in the name of anti-communism, and that was the justification, is the film exposes the total fallacy of it. The best argument they had was that communists sleep with other men's wives.
Yeah, exactly. And he's talking, and he's sort of saying, you hear these accusations from, you hear people saying this about Adi's family, and we're immersed in Adi's family in the film, and we feel this family of love and dignity and mutual care and almost something like approaching grace. And to hear these kind of malicious and obviously ad hominem slanders, it feels particularly brutal when you see how the fear in which everyone's been forced to live.
Right.
It's stigma. The history lesson that we see the children being forced to learn, where the genocide is celebrated, the victims are kind of demonized, the families, the relatives of the victims are talked about as people who should be kept under government surveillance. This is incitement and intimidation masquerading as a history lesson.
And I imagine it has the overall effect of making the population extremely passive.
Yes, and it has the effect of making anyone connected to a victim, any survivor's family, feel like a Jew living in Germany after the Nuremberg race laws. Terrified, feeling like the whole society, that the government wants you dead. And it of course, that leaves you silent.
Well, we can only hope that so far your film has done a lot of good, both here in the United States and in particular in Indonesia, and perhaps it will bring some of these skeletons out of the closet. And it's pretty hard to justify the old Cold War notion that Indonesia controls the Straits of Malacca, what the military call the SLOCs, the sea lanes of communication. All of that nonsense, is pretty antiquated now. It's hard to justify supporting this kind of government.
I think it was a cynical excuse to start with.
Well, I think you've done an amazing job for us all, and particularly the people of Indonesia, and I thank you for joining us, Joshua Oppenheimer.
Thank you ever so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Oppenheimer, a two-time Oscar-nominated film director based in Copenhagen, who recently spent 12 years in Indonesia before returning with two documentary films, the first of which, The Act of Killing, profiles perpetrators of the 1965 Indonesian genocide as they reenact their war crimes without remorse. That film is followed up with his new feature documentary, nominated for this year's Academy Award, The Look of Silence, which is just out in theaters. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.